Welcome to What Matters in North Carolina. Happy Monday to you. My name is Mark Shiver. So glad to have you listening to the program. We have a really packed show for you today. Of course, our Mayor Monday segment, we'll be talking with Mayor Debbie Smith from Ocean Isle. Also, Congressman Mark Meadows will be stopping by to talk about some recent legislation that he has filed in somewhat of an unusual case that we hope that you'll find interesting. And then we'll be talking with the president of the Civitas Institute, Francis DeLuca. We'd like to remind you right at the top of the show today that you still have time to register for the Civitas Poll Breakfast coming up this Thursday, September 15th, 7:45 in the morning. Now, you might be saying, wait a minute, Mark, that's usually a poll lunch. And yes, you're right. But this month, we're having a poll breakfast to discuss the results of our most recent poll at the Civitas Institute. Guest speakers will be Bob Rosser and Brad Crone. Both are political consultants and should be very interesting to see what the latest results of the Civitas poll are as we get closer to the election. So this Thursday, mark your calendar, 7:45 a.m. It will be held at the Doubletree by Hilton, 1707 Hillsborough Street in Raleigh. You might remember that, of course, as the old Brownstone Hotel that it was for many, many years. If you're listening to the program and you'd like to sign up, you can go to nccivitas.org/breakfast. Use the code FAN and you'll receive 10% off. So very excited about the most recent Civitas poll coming up and the poll breakfast this Thursday, September 15th at 7:45 in the morning. And the biggest news, I guess, over the weekend was Hillary Clinton looking like she needed to be not only helped, but actually lifted up into a van as she was under the weather, so to speak. They've come out and said that she has pneumonia. And yet a few hours after being transported to her daughter Chelsea's apartment in New York, she reappeared and looked very, very healthy, looked a lot thinner, and was talking to a child, which you wonder, if someone has pneumonia, should they be breathing into a child's face? But anyway, those are issues that I guess will sort themselves out in the days to come. But again, the North Carolina continuing to be a destination state during this presidential campaign. Donald Trump going to be in Asheville, and Joe Biden will be in North Carolina as well this week. So a lot going on in the state. Front page of the News and Observer in Raleigh was Governor McCrory and his opponent, Attorney General, so to speak, Roy Cooper, and talking about McCrory having to deal with this perception that somehow he has changed. And he's saying he's not changed, and in some cases trying to put the onus on the General Assembly as being somewhat more conservative, and Roy saying that the GOP had it out for him from the start. And so the histrionics are getting hot and heavy now as we approach the election. As of course Labor Day hit, it meant that everything was wide open. Campaigning is in full force for all of the elections. I saw where Dan Blue III and Dale Falwell, both running for North Carolina State Treasurer, were on television this weekend, and I heard a replay of that on the radio, and talking about the unfunded liability that North Carolina's pension will be facing in the years to come, actually is facing now, also problems with the state health plan. And one of the questions that the new treasurer is going to have to answer in North Carolina is, can the state afford, literally, can the state afford to continue to provide the kind of rich health insurance benefits that it provides to all state employees? I think when I was working there, I was paying, I don't know, somewhere around $16 every paycheck every 2 weeks for single health insurance coverage. And, you know, when you multiply this by the thousands and thousands of state employees, teachers, and everyone else, it's quite a hefty tab. And so we recall that last year somebody, there was a committee that said, you know, we need to make some changes into the state's contribution on behalf of employees. And, you know, the whole state just nearly, you know, went into a catatonic state thinking that employees might have to actually help pay more for their health insurance. But practically speaking, it's really a serious question. How long will North Carolina be able to provide the rich health insurance benefits that it provides to its employees, including the vast number of teachers? And so the next state treasurer is going to have to look at that issue, along with the fact that based on an unrealistic rate of return, which I think Treasurer Cowell is pegged at 7.5%, the pension plan is unfunded. So money is going to have to be diverted from the General Assembly's general fund to the treasurer's office to continue to meet the growing pension responsibilities. So this is not just another election. This race for treasurer is really, really important. And I hope that it doesn't get, you know, kind of swept under the rug in the midst of, well, we're voting for president, we're voting for governor, we're voting for attorney general, lieutenant governor, all these things. Stop and, you know, really think about this. Who will be the best equipped to deal with what will be some pretty serious issues going forward facing the next treasurer for the state of North Carolina? We've got a show theme today that deals with property rights, and I want you to stay closely tuned because we're going to talk with Congressman Mark Meadows about government overreach in that will affect some families in the western part of the state. And we're also going to take a look at how important personal property rights are and how government has been encroaching upon those for years and what can be done about that. So as we move forward, stay tuned to today's show. Please invite your friends and family to listen. As always, they can go to freedomactionnetwork.com, or you can download the show anytime in the iTunes and Google Play stores as well. Finally, you can follow us on Twitter at WhatMattersNC, at WhatMattersNC, and you can hit me up at Mark Shiver. We'd love to engage with you in social media. Joining us now is Mayor Debbie Smith from Ocean Isle. Mayor Smith, welcome to What Matters in North Carolina. And just tell us, if you can, first of all, exactly where is Ocean Isle? I know it's down on the coast, but if someone wanted to travel down there, what would be the best way to go?
Ocean Isle is a barrier island. We're the second beach inside of North Carolina if you were coming from the south. So we're very close to South Carolina state line. We're about a seven-mile-long island separated from the mainland by the intercoastal waterway. Quiet, pristine beaches, family-type atmosphere. You need to come.
Yeah, sounds like it. When you decide that you wanted to get involved in politics and you decided you'd like to be the mayor of a town like Ocean Isle, what motivated you to do that? What were some of the things that went through your head? Was it just you wanted to serve the people, give back a little bit? What prompted you to get into politics at the local level?
Well, I wasn't born here, but I've been raised on Ocean Isle Beach since before there was a bridge to the island.
Wow.
My parents moved here in the 50s before there was any development here. Matter of fact, moved here 6 months after a hurricane had flooded the island. So it was home. I grew up here. I certainly care about it. I care about the environment. I care about the way the development, the island has been developed. So I did want to give back. And so here I am. I've done this for 30 years.
Wow.
Either as town council or over a dozen years as mayor.
Wow, that's fascinating. You really are giving back to your community. Our guest is Mayor Debbie Smith of Ocean Isle here on our Mayor Monday segment on What Matters in North Carolina. Now, I'm looking online. There's quite a bit to do besides just go to the beach and enjoy, as you say, the pristine family atmosphere. There's a museum of coastal Carolina there. Tell us about that.
There is. We had a very generous property owner here who decided to make this one of his contributions in life and raise money to build this museum. Also was very instrumental in stocking it. It has wonderful coastal exhibits as well as local wildlife exhibitions. It's really a very hands-on and a learning center for our community and for the whole end of this county. We get a lot of school kids over here. They actually have an undersea diorama where you can see all the fish and everything,
wow.
Not live, but it makes you feel like you're walking under the water.
Yeah.
But so, and they have great, great educational programs throughout the year for adults as well as school children.
Now, our guest, Mayor Debbie Smith of Ocean Isle, you've also got the Ingram Planetarium there.
The same philanthropist was instrumental in building that as well. It's actually in our neighboring town of Sunset, but they're sister facilities, and it's quite a accomplishment for this end of Brunswick County as well.
So in terms of growth of Ocean Isle, I know that, for example, I live in a town that's kind of a bedroom community to Raleigh, and it has exploded over the past 20 years or so, going from about 3,000 to 16,000. Do you have you experienced similar growth, or has the population remained fairly stable there at Ocean Isle?
Well, we have had some growth. Our current census shows that we now have about 622 permanent residents.
Wow.
But that does swell in the summertime to about 25,000 people. So that's quite a contrast from our winter months and our permanent voting population to what we are hosting, and the property owners as well as the visitors here in the summertime.
What's the dynamic of that, Mayor Smith? This question just came to my mind when you said that. You guys, you know, you have your way of life, and pretty much throughout most of the year, things are, you know, I guess what you would say normal. And then all of a sudden, you know, the weather starts getting warm and here they come, you know, and I know you rely on tourism a lot, but what's it like living there to suddenly have your, you know, your home turf invaded with all these tourists?
Well, most of us don't feel like it's an invasion. Luckily, we attract a lot of families, and they're here with, you know, their extended families and kids. So it's still a very quieter, more laid-back atmosphere. They're on the beach. They're kayaking. They're boating. They're playing golf. So it's wholesome-type activities most of the time. It does get crowded, and we have our rush hours on check-in days, but it's a couple of hours one day a week, and other than that, they're all out enjoying themselves and the natural beauty we have here. So it's nice to see Memorial Day come, and we have a lot of visitors, but it's nice to see Labor Day come, and it gets a little quieter.
I can imagine. In terms of traffic, I know that my family goes down to Topsail during the summer most of the time. My father-in-law has a place down there, but the traffic can really get pretty busy during, you know, big weekends like Memorial Day, 4th of July, and that sort of thing. Is the traffic around there manageable even at the peak of the summer season, or is it just you got to grin and bear it?
It is. It is very manageable. Like I say, we have a busy couple hours on check-in day, which is a Saturday for us, because most of the rental companies check them all in at the same time. But other than that afternoon, that does kind of have a line of traffic coming in for several hours, it's quite manageable. Most people are on the beach or enjoying themselves instead of riding up and down the roads. We don't have a lot of commercial activity, So that keeps them, you know, more grounded. Hopefully they'll be on their bike or on their kayak instead of in their car all day.
What, in terms of the things that you as a mayor have to deal with as far as, you know, municipal government and that sort of thing, do you think it's pretty similar to what most smaller towns have to deal with, or are there special challenges that you have to face being the mayor of an ocean town? I imagine there's, you know, beach-related stuff that other places may not have to deal with.
Yes, it is. You know, we still have all the same challenges that any small town does, but we also have the extra challenges of being a coastal community and a resort community, and those certainly bring their own issues and things that you have to address. And, of course, you know, providing a nice resort area and a quiet family beach is very important to our community. and protecting that strand. You know, our economic engine is our tourism business, and that's about the only economy we have here. So it's valuable to us. We appreciate these people coming down here and choosing these lovely North Carolina beaches to bring their families to vacation.
Absolutely. In fact, I was reading, I guess it's been a couple of weeks ago now, maybe about 10 days, where some of the reports were coming in, and tourism has been exceptionally good last year and this year on the coast. Do you feel like that's an accurate description of how you guys have fared throughout the last couple of years as Ocean Isle?
Yes. Yes, we certainly have. It's been a good season.
Well, that's really good. Now, have you ever ventured over to Bird Island and looked into the mailbox there, the Kindred Spirit mailbox?
I certainly have, and I've written in that Kindred Spirit mailbox.
That sounds pretty cool. I was reading about it in preparation for our time together, and I guess it stays pretty full most of the time, huh?
I believe it does. It's been a while since I've been over there. Actually, you know, 20 years ago, you had to cross an inlet to get there or go by boat, but the inlet has closed up, and you can actually walk there from Sunset Beach now. So it's quite a interesting place to go. There are very few uninhabited islands that are that accessible along the coast here until you get up in the Outer Banks, but this is just very accessible. You can take your bike and ride it down the beach to go to Bird Island.
How about that? Well, you know, you just made a point that I think is worth talking about just a little bit. You know, there aren't very many, you know, uninhabited places left on the coast, whether it's South Carolina, North Carolina. And when I had the opportunity one time to go down to Hunting Island, which was near Hilton Head, and there's absolutely nothing there except the lighthouse. There's absolutely no development. And it really took my breath away to see a beach like that that had, you know, was still in its completely natural state without having been changed at all by beachgoers or development or anything like that. So it really is something when you get an opportunity to venture out and just kind of stand around and look around and take it all in.
I agree with you. I agree with you there. But it's nice to have a place for all of us to come and spend a few days and enjoy that kind of environment too.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that Ocean Isle is one of the beaches in North Carolina that has a fabulous reputation. And as you said, you're there close to the South Carolina border. I'm sure there's excellent seafood eating around there, and some of that the good calabash style food as well, right?
There certainly is. And, you know, we're only about 8 miles from Calabash, you know, the seafood capital of the world. So.
So finally, our guest, Mayor Debbie Smith of Ocean Isle, if there were one thing besides obviously going to the beach that if I were to come down in the next week or two, what is the one must-see attraction, must-do thing that Ocean Isle that I'd have to do before I left?
You have to enjoy a sunrise, and you have to enjoy a sunset.
Oh, wow.
Those
I bet it's something else.
Those are the two things that you must do. And this time of the year are the most beautiful. From now through mid-November are the most beautiful sunsets and sunrises.
Wow. Well, that's something I definitely will have to take you up on. One last thought. In terms of your relationship as a mayor with other communities and even with the General Assembly in Raleigh, do you find that you're able to maintain a good working relationship with the folks that represent Ocean Isle in the General Assembly and with your other municipal peers, mayors, and council people and folks like that?
Yes, actually, I think the coastal mayors and counties work well together. You know, there's only 20 of us coastal counties that have to deal with, you know, beaches and devastating storms sometime. And from the Outer Banks to all the way down through Brunswick County, we all know each other. We all work together because when we go to Raleigh, we have 20 representatives in the Senate, and the rest of the state has 80. So our voice has to be loud on our needs and what we need from the state. So our coastal communities do work well together. We meet on a regular basis and a couple of times a year, so, and share our successes and our failures and seek advice, and it's worked well for us.
Well, Mayor Debbie Smith of Ocean Isle, you're very gracious to spend time with us here. I hope that I'll be able to get to Ocean Isle soon. Thank you for spending time with us here on What Matters in North Carolina. You represent Ocean Isle very well, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Just come visit, and you'll know how wonderful it is.
All right. Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
All right. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye. Joining us now on What Matters in North Carolina, Congressman Mark Meadows. He represents folks in the western part of our state. Always a pleasure to have you on the program. Welcome back, sir.
Mark, it's great to be back with you. It's certainly always a pleasure to join you and your listeners, and look forward to chatting with you.
Well, Congressman, before we get into some issues that have to do with property rights and government overreach, yesterday was the 15th anniversary of the tragic attack on our country on September 11th of 2001. I thought I'd ask you appropriately what your thoughts were yesterday as you recalled that horrific day.
Well, the attacks 15 years ago obviously made a very big difference in the lives of so many. I know a number of us will never forget where we were. But additionally, it really changed who we were as Americans. We have to be vigilant and know that terrorism, Islamic extremism, is alive and well, not only abroad, but here in the United States. And so for me, it was an opportunity to honor our first responders, our firefighters, our law enforcement, emergency service personnel, and to thank them once again. We had a number of events across the state, and certainly we attended four or five different events on this anniversary. But we must realize that it's not just on September 11th that we need to remain vigilant, but it's each and every day of the year. And we also need to give thanks to those first responders each and every day of the year.
Our guest is Congressman Mark Meadows. And on a personal note, Congressman, I realize that as citizens, we all were terrified, and we remain somewhere in the back of our minds, always aware that something like this could happen again, God forbid. But as someone who is a member of Congress, there's got to be an added layer of pressure for you personally, not just as a citizen, but someone who has been elected to represent people and to help maintain vigilance in keeping our country safe. How do you deal with that type of added responsibility in your day-to-day life as a congressman?
Mark, I apologize. I'm just getting every fourth word from you for some reason, so we're going to have to do I couldn't hear. I heard it was on a personal note, but that's all I heard.
Okay, let me try again. Can you hear me better now?
Yes, I can hear you now.
Okay. On a personal note, Congressman Meadows, we as citizens carry in the back of our minds that something like that could happen again, and we hope that it does not. But as someone who has been elected to serve in Congress, there has to be an added level of pressure that you deal with trying to keep our country safe. How do you deal with that from day to day as someone who's been elected to Congress?
Well, there is an added layer of pressure to really make sure that we stay safe and we continue to do what is necessary and give the resources that are necessary to support a defense and make for a strong national security. But I think the real pressure comes in the frustration of what can't get done and the fact that too many times with a strong national defense, they don't have the funding requirements that they need. We seem to miss the priorities, and so I can tell you it is one of those things that keeps me up at night because of the classified information that I get to see, and knowing that American lives may be in harm's way if we don't do our job. So for me, it's about staying committed, but it's also about perhaps burning the midnight oil a little bit more to see if there's more area that we can address to make sure that we have a strong defense.
Well, we certainly do appreciate all that you are doing for our country and right here in North Carolina, a little bit closer to home now. On Friday, I read that you had filed a bill that would intervene in something that the Tennessee Valley Authority is doing, and it relates to people who actually live on the water. Why don't you tell us a little bit about this legislation dealing with floating homes?
Well, we've actually, Mark, this particular issue with regards to the Tennessee Valley Authority was an arbitrary decision made by their board, a very activist board, in my opinion, that was challenging the floating homes that are on many of the lakes, not only in North Carolina, but across the Southeast. I was most concerned about those constituents that I represent. They brought the issue to me. I appealed the decision of the board. I went to their CEO. I did all the things that you would normally do to show how their decision that they came to was not based on fact, was not really based on anything other than an activist agenda to take away the rights of many families who have been enjoying houseboats on those lakes since the late 50s. And so for me, it was about introducing a piece of legislation and being responsible to the people that I represent. I'm glad to say that our senators, Senator Burr and Senator Tillis, have done the same on the Senate side. So we're hopeful that we'll be able to address it. But it fundamentally really underscores a different area, Mark. It shows how agencies and quasi-governmental agencies are becoming more and more hostile to the very people that they're supposed to serve. They want to have their own agenda instead of the people's agenda. And for me, I'm not going to tolerate that. We're going to be all in to make sure that we stand on behalf of the people that we represent.
Well, I know that the folks up there on Fontana Lake appreciate you standing up on their behalf. I really was not that familiar with the fact that there was probably over 400 people here in North Carolina alone on Fontana Lake who live in what is described as a floating home or a floating cabin. And part of the attraction, as you know, Congressman Meadows, is that this is something that these families want to leave as a legacy to their children and their grandchildren. And this decision by the Tennessee Valley Authority to prohibit this, even though it's many years out in the future, this is something that is going to affect these families if change isn't made. And it really, as you said, points to government overreach, in this case, by a quasi-governmental agency.
Well, it is indeed that, Mark. I mean, when you look at everything that we're talking about, it's families. I got to meet with a lot of these families, and they're not necessarily families of means. It's been passed from one generation to another. It's part of their family memories and history, and yet we somehow have a standard by the TVA, which, by the way, doesn't make money, continues to have government subsidies in terms of loans that they get. They haven't properly funded their pension fund, and yet they go after, moms and dads and aunts and uncles and nieces and nephews that have enjoyed the lake for so often there on Montana. I don't find any excuse for it. I think they need to get their fiscal house in order before they start worrying about a floating home that has been there for well over 50 or 60 years.
Our guest is Congressman Mark Meadows, representing the folks in the western part of North Carolina. And I've done a little research on this, Congressman, and the folks that are in these homes seem to be very diligent to make sure that they are taking good care of the environment and being responsible citizens, even though their homes are on the water. It's not like they're filling the, Fontana Lake or Norris Lake with pollution. And yet this is something that the Tennessee Valley Authority has indicated as one of their concerns. But from everything I've read, these folks are doing a good job being responsible citizens of the environment.
Well, you're exactly right, Mark. I mean, they have not actually done anything that would harm the environment. In fact, quite the opposite. I went out, took a tour. The measures that they put forth to make sure that not only they enjoy it, but that others can enjoy the lake, it's probably better than most of the lakes in North Carolina. In fact, I was told when I took the tour that it's the third cleanest lake east of the Mississippi. And so to make a suggestion that there's an environmental impact that needs to be addressed is one that's just built on a false premise and not supported in fact. And so I think the coming days we'll get to see that. I'd love to come back with you. We're going to be holding a hearing on the 22nd of September on this very issue, but hopefully give the floating homeowners their day to express not only what is important to them, but how they will be harmed by this arbitrary action.
And one last question, Representative Meadows, in terms of timeline with, you know, this being an election year and all that, is there a chance that your bill will be heard before the end of the year, before the end of this session, or will it have to be held over, do you think, until January?
Yeah, we're looking at a timeline. As I said, for the hearing, we're going to actually look at that timeline here on the 22nd in terms of what we're trying to do with a hearing. But additionally, the legislation, it looks like that the legislation that I've introduced and our senators have introduced will get very quick action in the next 30 days. As you know, the TVA put a sunset provision that said that this is going to be something that's addressed over the next 30 years. But I believe that we've got to make sure that we reverse it in this first six-month window. And so we're all hands on deck to make sure that we address it right away, and I'm committed to seeing it through.
Well, Congressman Meadows, I know the folks over there in the counties that you represent in Caldwell and Haywood and Henderson and Mitchell appreciate that you're looking out for them, and we appreciate, as always, you being our guest here on What Matters in North Carolina. Thank you very much, sir.
Well, Mark, it was great to be with you, and, you know, we got to get back to where representatives actually represent the people, and hopefully we'll do that. So God bless you, and God bless your listeners.
Thank you, sir, and same to you, and we appreciate it and hope you have a very good day.
Thank you. Take care.
All right. Thank you, sir. Well, today we've been talking about property rights, private property, an important part of our country's foundation. In fact, Thomas Jefferson said in 1816, the true foundation of republican government is the equal right of every citizen in his person and property and in their management. Joining us now to talk about this and how important property rights are in 2016, Francis DeLuca, president of the Civitas Institute. Francis, welcome back to What Matters in North Carolina.
Mark, good to be with you. And this is an important topic. Property rights is an important topic.
Well, it certainly is something that we've heard a lot about of in the news recently. In fact, we just had Congressman Mark Meadows on the show talking about the Tennessee Valley Authority trying to run people out of their floating homes, which they've been living on Lake Fontana and in Tennessee on Norris Lake for decades. And now suddenly the TVA doesn't want them there anymore, and they're giving them time to pack up and move out. But this is just an example of people who own property and a quasi-governmental agency coming in and trying to displace them, and it just doesn't seem right.
Well, it's kind of these arbitrary decisions to, you know, do things like that. And so, you know, I'm not too familiar with the TVA thing, you know, but if the, you know, if at some point in the past they had to allow that. They didn't just do it. They didn't squat on the lake.
Right.
So they had to allow them, and, you know, people have invested money and everything. And really what this gets back to, and Thomas Jefferson and our founding fathers, part of the reason our country was established was because of arbitrary things like taxes that were being imposed without the consent of the governed. That would be the American colonist.
Right.
You know, about when the British would house people in, put troops in houses. That was about taking a property. That was about using your, you know, your house as a, basically as a barracks,
right,
without compensating you or without asking your permission. You know, other things where they would take stuff from people and confiscate things. And so, you know, up to this time, in even in England, they couldn't do some of those things. So, but over time, the ideal of private property has emerged, and it's become kind of fundamentally linked to freedom. And the reason is because, you know, in the feudal days, in the days in some parts of the world, the government, through the king or queen and, you know, the royalty, they could just do anything they wanted. They could go and they could go, Mark, we like your house. We're taking it. Thank you. So without that concept of private property, there really isn't freedom, because part of freedom is to, you know, own things and to have the ability to provide for yourself. So if you have like a horse or a mule and you're tilling your land, and the king or the duke or the earl comes by and says, Mark, fine looking donkey there, I'm taking it with me, suddenly you can't till your land.
That's
you
fine.
No longer have the freedom to feed your family or to earn a living. You know, now you can indenture yourself to somebody else, or you can go steal, or you can go beg, or you maybe get a job, but the freedom you had was gone. So that's why when we talk about property rights, how important they really are. And that is one of the things that it's been the center of a lot of the different arguments. And even today, when we talk about things like taxes and everything, we are talking about property rights. Taxes are a governmental taking of stuff. And we have agreed that, you know, we've kind of come to an agreement that some taxes are necessary, and that the government has a right to tax to provide for the common good and defense and things like that. The question is, where is the appropriate level of taxation has always been one of the, you know, kind of central arguments in our political thing. But also, you know, you have to acknowledge that the only way government gets their taxes is at the point of a gun.
Yeah.
People don't like that kind of imagery, but it's true. Nobody really voluntarily pays taxes. They know there's a threat from the government to pay them. Now, some people more or less voluntarily, like, I have no problem filling out my taxes. I don't like doing it every year, but I do it. And nobody has to hold a gun to my head.
Right.
There's other people who have a little more problem with that, and they don't want to pay taxes, and they feel the government has no right to collect it. But now, like I said, we've come to a point where that isn't where we are. We are that taxes are a legitimate action of government. But, you know, this goes back to property. You know, in terms of keeping your property, the people in the lake, you know, we have the things out west where ranchers are not allowed to graze anymore because the Bureau of Land Management has decided that that is not a suitable use of a land. So
exactly.
we're gonna take away grazing rights. Well, that was essentially property rights for people. They were existed because they could graze their animals there and then sell them. But suddenly when someone takes that away, it is in essence taking a property right from them. And one of the issues in North Carolina over the years, there have been a couple of issues that have to do with property rights that are fundamental. A good one a few years ago that was very hot, and when the Republicans took over, they really went after it pretty quickly, and that was forced annexation. Mm-hmm. That's where towns and cities would annex areas where the people didn't want to be annexed.
That's right.
But they would take it, and they would say it's necessary because these people are coming into town and using government services. Therefore, we need their taxes to support our government services. And the people's argument was, wait a minute, we moved here outside of town so that we didn't have to be in town. We don't have to subscribe to your water, sewer, trash collection, or pay your taxes. But now you want to take our land and basically take our property by making us pay taxes on the land we already own. And we get nothing, you know, you give us something, but we don't want it. So in a sense, that's a property rights question, the whole idea of forced annexation. It's telling you what you can do with your property, because along with forced annexation come all kinds of city rules and everything in terms of how you use your property, all those things. So that was one example of a kind of a property rights issue that happened a few years ago and has been settled. Another one is eminent domain.
Boy, that's a big one.
It always has been a big one, and it flares up every once in a while. We saw the latest flare up here in North Carolina with the CSX hub that was originally going to locate in Johnson County.
That's right.
And the only way they could have done that was to use eminent domain to take some property that people did not want to willingly sell. And that's been a big point of contention as to what is appropriate eminent domain. Most people would agree that it is appropriate if the government uses eminent domain to for things like water lines, sewer lines,
right.
Maybe even power lines. Today, we can't exist without power. So, you know, allowing the power company to use eminent domains to locate power lines is a good that needs to happen, because most people are not going to put up their own power lines and everything. So,
sure.
So, you know, and now the question is, does that extend to something like a train, you know, depot? Is that a common good? It used to be that, you know, when the trains back in the 1800s were being expanded, they expanded using eminent domain. The government took land and gave it to the trains. You know, they took thousands and thousands.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Hundreds of thousands of acres and gave it to the railroad companies. And that's because they wanted the trains built. So, you know, that's a case of, you know, kind of eminent domain. But what we saw more and more in the last 20, 30, 40 years was eminent domain being used. It was used up north in a lot of inner cities, some of the bigger cities in the south. They would go in and take areas of the city that they considered blighted, and they would take the area and then turn it over to somebody else, another
right.
commercial developer. In other words, it wasn't government taking it for a government good. It was government saying, we think this land has a higher and better use than what you're using it for now. Therefore, we're going to take it from you. We're going to pay you what we think we should pay you and what we can get a court to agree to. And then we're going to give it to Francis.
Yeah.
Because Francis wants to put a high-rise building on it, or Francis wants to put a casino on it, or Francis wants to put a shopping mall on
yeah.
it. But what ended up happening was Mark's single-family home there, he lost. And even though he got paid, that may not be enough to buy him a home that is similarly useful to him. In other words, the price of housing is going up, so he is not going to get paid. He can't go buy another house and not have a mortgage on it.
One of the things, Francis, that I've been fascinated listening to you kind of break this down, because I want to go back to one of the very first things that you said, because I have to admit candidly that I had not thought about property rights in this way before, but it really is tied into liberty. I mean, if a government can come in and take your house or your land, then you're really not free. And that's a big, big difference between a conservative ideology that calls for smaller government and rare cases of government encroaching on private property, as opposed to a liberal ideology, which is more favorable to this type of an environment.
Absolutely right. And that's really, you know, as you told me about the topic today, and I said that, you know, so I kind of thought about it a little, and I said, we're really, you know, I didn't have to think long before the whole thing about that property rights are inextricably linked to personal freedom, because without property rights, you really have no personal freedom. Now, it literally, take the clothes off your back if people don't have personal property rights.
That's
because,
right.
you know, if I'm a government official, Mark, give me your clothes. Well, wait a minute. Those are my clothes. No, they aren't. They're our clothes.
Yeah. Wow.
And you know, people go, oh, you're being extreme. But there are cases where people have been treated like that. And there are a lot of countries in the world that still exist in that kind of thing, where people don't have their own personal property rights. I mean, if you look at one of the things about communist China, you know, about the communist China, is they don't really respect property rights. That's why we have such a hard time with intellectual property. They steal intellectual property from American companies all the time. Now, it's such a big market, a lot of American companies turn a blind eye to it, because they want to sell property. They want to sell things in the country. So they allow China to ignore the theft of intellectual property in return for being able to operate in China.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, you know, selling someone the hammer they're going to beat you on the head with, but it's kind of funny. But they're closely linked.
Well, the framers of our Constitution and the founding fathers, just to kind of drive this point home, they really saw liberty and property as intertwined. One did not exist without the other. Jefferson and Monroe and others. Do a Google search on their quotes about property rights, and I mean, it's page after page after page. This was something that they really saw as important. In fact, the Fifth Amendment talks about you can't take property without just compensation and process.
And that was a lot of, you know, that grew directly out of the revolution, because that was one of the reasons they rebelled against the rulers in England, because they were not respecting the property rights of the colonists. And, you know, and this goes, and like I said, this goes back to the whole ideal that, you know, if you don't own your own property, if you don't own your own things, you really can't truly be free, because you cannot be secure in what you have. And once that, once you're secure, you can build on what you have. You know, if you're a farmer, you can add acreage because you know that you're going to have those 10 mules and those implements to work the fields.
Right.
You know, and you can, and when you harvest the grain, it's your grain, you know, that you can then sell. And that's why property rights are so important. Now, if you're a manufacturer and you manufacture something, you don't have to worry about the government coming in and say, oh, well, we need half of that so that we can sell it.
Yeah.
You know, and I say government because that's usually who it is. And government does not necessarily mean that, you know, the government like the U.S. A lot of places it means the dictator, the king, the whatever it might be, the ruling Politburo. You know, like I said, there are still exercises of that around the world. You know, Russia today, you know, it's kind of ruled by oligarch. And there's still a lot of things in Russia where the government comes in on behalf of other rich people and kind of forces sales of businesses to these other people. That is a place where property rights are not secure.
That's right.
You know, if you're forced to sell to somebody, then you really don't own what you have.
What do you think, one case that I think needs further explanation, and we had Dave Bremer of the Pacific Legal Foundation on last week to talk about this, and he did a really good job, but I think it bears repeating. Francis, our guest Francis DeLuca here on What Matters in North Carolina, president of the Civitas Institute, down in Emerald Isle. This is a perfect example. Now, here's some people that own some property, and it's actually part of the beach, and the town decided to take part of their property and make it part of a thoroughfare where they could drive their town maintenance vehicles and such across. They did not compensate them. They did not go through any kind of legal proceedings. The local newspapers painted this as a doomsday scenario where, oh my gosh, people aren't going to be able to lay out on the beach or walk in the sand, which is not true. These people that own this land, they just want what the Fifth Amendment says. There's a procedure and a just compensation.
Well, and wanted to talk to that. This has been one of the most, you know, kind of, we at Civitas have gotten more kind of input, feedback, I'm being nice here, from people. We've gotten some positive stuff too. Some people have said, yes, we have a similar situation where the government's doing something to us that is similar to Emerald Isle. But to explain, you know, you explained it fairly well. What the town of Emerald Isle, and I'm not a lawyer on the case. I'm not a lawyer, period. But when we had a lawyer at Civitas who filed a brief in support of the Pacific Legal Foundation, and they're representing the homeowners in Emerald Isle. And in North Carolina, to give everybody kind of a full thing, as a beach owner, if you own an oceanfront home, you own to the high water mark of the beach. So in other words, you own from, you know, the property line in the on the mainland, on the land side, all the way to the high water mark on the ocean side.
Okay.
The highest where the water comes up to. You pay taxes on that. You theoretically own it. Now, we have some rules governing construction on the beach. You cannot build to the high water mark. You can only build from the vegetation line back. And in North Carolina, there's a whole complicated formula for where you can build on the land. So you already have some restrictions on your property rights.
Yeah.
But those are pretty much agreed on, and they are in the public.
People live with that.
They've been tested in court, and they're based on how they're good for the public at large. And it's not a unfair taking that you still have use of your property.
Right.
But you have some things that protect other people too.
Okay.
So that said, what has happened, and you know, you go to the high water mark, and they're what's called dry sand. Mm-hmm. North Carolina has also had what's known as a public use doctrine for the beaches. And that's basically that the dry sand up to the line of vegetation is open to anybody to walk on. In other words, you cannot fence off your property down to the high water mark.
Okay.
So in front of the dune, people can walk back and forth. You know, you can walk in the water, you can walk in the dune. You know, it is against the law to walk in the dunes and destroy the plants. I mean, that is a law that so you don't have unfettered access to that. Even as a property owner, you know, you can only use that if you're doing some work or something like that.
Okay.
You know? So the town of MLL comes along and goes, well, we want to be able to run our emergency vehicles, so we're going to designate this strip of the beach. And again, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm kind of paraphrasing some of this. We're going to designate this strip of beach as basically a road.
All right.
And so the homeowners go, what? Yeah, well, we need to make sure that you don't put any objects in this area. You don't. We want to be able to run vehicles up and down here. And in some places, you can actually drive private vehicles on the beach. You know, a lot of North Carolina beaches allow private vehicles at different times of the year.
Yeah, that's
true. We want to keep this area clear. And, and the homeowners went, well, that's fine. We think you should compensate us for taking our property because you're basically putting a road through our front yard. You know, that's our front yard. We pay taxes on it. According to the deed, we own it. So we're fine with you putting it through it, but we want compensation. Sure. And the town goes, heck no. You know, we have the public use doctrine says we can use it. And, but this is a case where it's a government unit doing it, basically creating a thoroughfare through their yard without saying we're going to pay. It is not prohibiting the town from running an emergency vehicle across the beach to help somebody.
Right.
It's saying, but you can't just run vehicles up and down this for any reason, and you can't allow private vehicles. You can't designate this a roadway without compensating us. Well, when we filed the brief, we've had people just hollering because, again, part of legal things are not just legal. It's also public relations.
Right.
So, of course, the Pacific Legal Foundation and the owners and our brief would say, yes, this is a taking by the Constitution, and therefore those people need to be compensated. The other side said this is an attempt to end the public use doctrine to not allow people to walk on the dry sand beach in North Carolina, which is not what the case is doing.
Not at all.
And I don't believe any court in North Carolina or any federal court would go that far to ending North Carolina's historic dry sand use of the beach. If we were going to end the dry sand use, the courts or the lawsuit would say you can't allow people to drive on the sand anytime.
Yeah.
But that's not what it's saying. And so the people who are kind of reacting to this and saying, oh, you're a bunch of people from New Jersey trying to change our laws and you don't understand. And we need to be able to walk on the beach anywhere we want. I think that's great. I do that. I walk on the beach all the time.
Sure.
When I go to the beach. I believe that is good. But I've also been to other places, not New Jersey, but like Florida, where they designate lanes on the beach for drivers. Guess what? You can't put things. You can't put a chair there. You can't put a blanket there. They, by doing this, are setting up the thing where the public access to the beach could be restricted because of the governmental access on the beach. In other words, if you build this thoroughfare, well, if it's a designated thing, they will come along and tell you to move your towel, move your chair, move your cooler, move your umbrella. I mean, they're not going to allow you to set up in it.
So
they are going to deny access to the dry sand beach.
So the people who are concerned about this are saying that the homeowner is wrong in defending the town, and yet it's actually over time, if this is allowed to stand, the town could actually be the one that comes up and bites them and takes away their use of dry sand beach.
Well, on a high tide, and you've got a designated thoroughfare, and that may be the only strip of dry sand beach, and they're going, sorry, you got to move your plant. Well, where am I going to move it? Well, you may just have to get off the beach.
Yeah.
Because we have to keep this clear so we can go help somebody on the beach, in case they're drowning or something. But that's kind of the, if you take things to their extreme,
right,
that's where you get to. But, this is in no way an attempt to take away dry sand access. It is an attempt to kind of keep the government in check from violating our Constitution and doing an unlawful taking. And that's a hard thing to explain to people because all they hear is some property owners want to stop people from using the beach.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a much easier thing to do. But the basic concept, this is where things get complicated. This is where people's people's rights run into other people's expectations.
That's good. Just to kind of put a bow on this, what I was thinking as you were describing this is if this is allowed to stand in 15, 20 years, then because the law often evolves out of what has been going on for a decade or two, that thoroughfare might actually be recognized as something that belongs to the municipalities, and all of the homeowners along the beach are just going to be, you know, out of luck and not having been compensated.
Well, I don't think it's going to take 15 or 20 years. If they win the suit, it in fact today that will be happening.
Wow. So,
and it will allow other municipalities to do the same thing, and you'll see that a number of them will quickly.
One of the things, Francis, as we bring this to a close, that I think that bears talking about briefly is, you know, we're in this presidential election, and North Carolina is a hot spot. All of the candidates are coming, and all of their surrogates are coming.
Isn't it fun?
And oh, it's wonderful. And certainly weekly, but almost daily, we've got somebody from some of the campaigns, or one of the campaigns coming, and people have talked about this election from the standpoint of a conservative versus a liberal future for our country. And thinking about this topic right here of private property and property rights and the way the Supreme Court would interpret the Fifth Amendment, this election is very important because the next president could be appointing justices to the Supreme Court.
Well, right now there's no could be.
Well, they will be appointing at least one.
At least one, and there's a chance of 2 to 4 justices. Yeah. I mean, we have a number of justices that are getting on up in years. So there will probably be several vacancies in the next term. And whoever the next appointee is, and then the next 2 of the 3, really will set legal policy for, you know, decades, possibly hundreds of years to come.
So we think about First Amendment free speech and freedom of religion. We think about, you know, the Second Amendment, folks. Yeah. But we don't often hear about this topic right here and how the interpretation by the Supreme Court of the Fifth Amendment and government taking people's property. This is something that will definitely be something that to watch in the next.
Property rights are very important. In fact, a few years ago, the Supreme Court did a case called the Kelo case from Connecticut, where they allowed a town to take private property and give it to another private entity. And that went all the way to the Supreme Court by 5-4. And that the makeup of the court has changed since then, but we haven't had another court case get there. By 5-4, the court said, yes, you can do that. And there was a lot of outrage. And one of the things in North Carolina we've tried to do is get an amendment in our state court, our state constitution that says in North Carolina, you cannot do that. But unfortunately, even with supposedly a Republican conservative legislature, they don't want to do that because development interests are very strong. Yeah. And you know, industrial recruiters like the idea that if there's a piece of land that the people don't want to sell, they can go to the government and get the government to make the people sell it to them. You know, the government comes in, buys it, and then sells it back to a private company to build a plant or to build a store or to build something on. And that's one of the reasons we haven't been able to get a eminent domain amendment on the North Carolina Constitution. Hopefully in the future, we may be able to get that so that the only taking of property can be for a legitimate public use.
I think the first bill filed in the 2015 long session was House Bill 2, which was eminent domain, and it didn't make it out of the General Assembly. Well, Francis DeLuca, thank you very much for enlightening us on this topic. It's been very educational. We appreciate you, as always, being our guest here today on What Matters in North Carolina.
Thank you, Mark, and great topic.
Well, Francis DeLuca making a great point that our country has been made great through people who own property and farms and land, and they've been able to build and employ people. And so the great economic success story of the United States certainly founded on the notion that liberty and property rights are intertwined. Absolutely. Great show today. Thank you for Francis DeLuca and Mayor Debbie Smith and also Congressman Mark Meadows for being our guest. We have another great show for you tomorrow, so stay tuned, and we'll look for you again on What Matters in North Carolina.